Coming from the backwoods of New Jersey, welcome to the Jersey Guys Music Podcast, where we feature in-depth music discussions and interviews with special guests from the worlds of hard rock, heavy metal, and AOR music. So settle in and crank it up. Now, here are your hosts, the Jersey Guys themselves, Tom and Mark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Jersey Guys podcast. I'm Mark Ballow here with my co-host, Tom Coyne. And today we've got a special guest who our AOR crowd or melodic hard rock crowd will probably know him from his longstanding band, Unruly Child. If we got any prog fans out there, we're going to talk about his band, World Trade. But this is a musician who's done a lot of other stuff. I mean, we're talking about a guy who's played with the Doobie Brothers, the Moody Blues, Air Supply. So we're going to touch on all that stuff tonight, but please welcome to the show keyboard player, producer, songwriter, Guy Allison. Welcome to the show, Guy.
Hello. How you guys doing?
Great to have you here.
Yeah. Thank you for taking a few minutes talking to us tonight.
Absolutely.
We could probably talk for a couple hours to you with all the stuff you've done in your career, but we're gonna try and streamline some ground. We're gonna try and streamline it as best as we can. In that spirit, I'm gonna hand it off to Tom. I think he's gonna start with the Logic stuff
with the band Logic, Guy. If that's all right, we could kind of start that as a because it was kind of a precursor to World Trade, which is a band I want to get into kind of more deeper with you. So if you could tell us how Logic came about, which was a lot of band members that went on to World Trade, and how you guys got signed and how the album came about.
Logic was a collection of musicians that had known each other since probably grade school in Las Vegas. And they got some very famous fathers and mothers that were, of the members, part of the band. Bobby Sherwood was Michael and Billy's father, and well-known conductor, arranger, jazz musician, who also appeared in a movie with Frank Sinatra, where he had a big speaking role in the movie called Pal Joey. So those guys kind of come from royalty in a way, And as a lot of musicians did in the 70s, they found work in Las Vegas, and they had families there. So the kids all knew each other in Las Vegas. They got a gig at a young age, maybe 20 years old. They got a gig playing up in Reno. And I was with another production where I was the musical director in Reno at another hotel. And the musicians that were in my band, everybody was from California. And we were up there in Reno playing this show, and nobody knew where to buy pot. they found this musician that was playing in another band down the street who was happy to sell some of the pot that he had. And that was Mike Sherwood. So they got to know Michael. They went to go see the shows, and they used to come back and tell me, "Guy, you got to go see this band." He says, "They're fucking brilliant." And I finally said, yeah, I'll go see them. And I went and watched the show and just fell in love. They were so good, these guys. And now Billy was just a kid. Billy wasn't even in the band yet. But Mike Sherwood was there, and Jimmy Hahn was there, and Gary Starnes was there. And as fate would have it, we became friends. They had two keyboard players in the band, and one of them quit. And Michael called me up and said, "You want to come play with Logic?" And I literally said, "Give me 1 second." Yes. And that was it. And I joined the band, and the show that we were playing moved from Reno to Tahoe. And then it closed, and the band was going to move home to Las Vegas. And I just said, "I'll go with you guys." So I just moved to Las Vegas. I didn't have a job. I didn't have a place to stay. But I loved the band. And we recorded while we were in Las Vegas, and we played some crappy little club gigs and stuff like that. And somebody heard us in Los Angeles and said, we like the demos you guys are making. You should try to come out here and get a record deal. So the whole band picked up and moved to LA, which is where I was from anyway. And we played in Hollywood. We kicked around in Hollywood forever trying to get a record deal. And everybody told us, we love you guys, keep writing. Love you guys, keep writing. And we were rehearsing at a place called Leeds, where they used to tell us, don't bother the stars. We were the only unsigned band in this place. It was like Kenny Loggins and Toto and Stevie Wonder and Pat Benatar. And,
wow.
You know, and us, a bunch of, you know, 21-year-olds that were playing in the clubs in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Anyway, a band came in. We had been kicking around there for about 3 years trying to get a record deal. And Jeff Porcaro walks into the room. And we didn't even notice him because we were in a writing session. So we're all facing each other on stage. And he says to one of our guys, it was, you know, we had a crew, if you could believe that, a crew. And he said, can I go get some friends of mine? And he says, yeah, go ahead. So he goes back and he gets everybody from Toto. He brings them into the room and they're standing against the wall. We finally realized, you know, about 3 minutes into them standing there, who was there in the rehearsal room.
Wow.
And we stopped and we looked at them and go, oh my God, it's you guys. And and they were like, oh, you guys are fucking great. You know, and Page comes up and he goes, what label are you guys on? And we said, we don't have a record deal. And he says, oh, so we'll fix that. So they took us under our wings and they got a place for us, you know, so that we could all just have a band house. And we had our gear and they sent up extra gear that they had. And they just said, write and record, just write and record, write and record. And then they finally helped us get a deal with A&M Records. And that was how Logic went from kicking around Hollywood trying to get a record deal to finally, you know, having one on A&M.
Wow.
Now, at that time, how did you guys get that sound? I mean, obviously, it sounded to me like Yes meets Asia with maybe a little drop of the Police.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. You just played Spot the Influences. It was everything that we liked. The band loved Yes. The band loved Genesis. The band loved the Police. The band loved Gabriel. And that stuff seeped through our pores into whatever we were writing and recording. So everybody brought, you know, their Supertramp love or their, you know, Beatles love or their Elton John love or their Yes love to the demos. And that's what the stuff sounded like.
Hmm. Now, at the time, that was 85-ish. It was...
Yeah, that's 85 was when the record came out.
Right. So it was the Trevor Rabin era of Yes.
Oh, God, like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was it. And we revered that record. We thought 90125 was the absolute, you know, that and Synchronicity and obviously Toto 4 and, you know, the stuff that was all big at that time, the Gabriel stuff. Mm-hmm. We were just, you know, disciples of all that stuff. Right. So it, you know, our writing couldn't help but sound reminiscent of that, I'm sure.
Now, how was that album received? Because in 85, it was kind of at the time when, like, the metal and the hair band stuff was right on the cusp of a breaking big in the States. Did the album well?
No, not at all. I don't think anybody cared about that record.
Well, I did. I bought it when it came out.
You know, if it came out and sold 50,000 units, I'd be surprised.
Okay.
But you know, they gave it a shot and they gave us a little bit of a support act shot for a few shows with Supertramp.
Yeah.
And they managed to get one of our tunes on the album into a ABC movie of the week. You know, they gave it a decent try, but I don't think, I think radio was turning at that point.
Yes.
So it, you know, we were, you know, maybe a couple years short.
Now there was a song on there in particular, Linda Sue. That was my favorite song on the album. It had a lot of, I would say borrowing, but I'm very close to the song Hold On by Yes. Would I be?
Okay, now here's the funny thing. It probably sounded like that, but that song was written way before that album came out.
Really?
I'll tell you what that song sounded like. A lot of people thought it sounds like something off of Toto 4, which was Why Don't We Make Believe We're in Love Again?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I could see that too, yeah.
You know that too, but that's not what it was. It was Misunderstanding by Genesis.
Really?
That's where we borrowed it from.
Wow. Because you know, at the very beginning of it, it sounds like Hold On from Yes.
Yeah.
You know,
but that's the coincidence. It was written before that.
Wow. Okay. I'm glad I brought that up. I would have never known that.
Yeah, but I remember people saying, oh, this sounds a lot like the Toto thing. And I go, no, it's Genesis. Trust me.
Okay. So I'm guessing you guys got dropped.
Yeah, we did. We got dropped. We lost our option. We tried to get another record deal. At that point we switched up and we got a, a different drummer, and we were working with we're still working with, I just forgot his name, our engineer, Greg Ladani. Greg Ladani was trying to help us showcase, and we had some interest over at EMI Manhattan with Bobby Colombi, but it just didn't take off. And we finally looked at each other and said, you know, we've been doing this for a long time. Let's just stop, you know, and everybody went their separate ways, basically. Although, ironically enough, I was still living in an apartment. My wife and I and Billy Sherwood and his girlfriend were still living together in an apartment.
Really?
when we said, let's go our separate ways. But ironically enough, it wasn't but a couple months after that, I got the tour with the Moody Blues. And during that year, while I was touring, Billy Sherwood ended up writing a lot of tunes with a good friend of ours named Bruce Gowdy, mm-hmm. who, as you also know, is the guitar player and my partner in Unruly Child.
Sure.
And they got some interest through the publishing company, Warner Chappell. They said, you guys should put together enough tunes to go for a record deal. Because I think they were just writing just to write. You know, that was the game back then. Get a publishing deal, write, you know, try to get some covers if you can.
Right.
And they said, get a band together. So they were just missing a drummer and a keyboard player. So they asked Mark Williams, who's John Williams' son, eldest son. And they asked me back. And so World Trade was started. And we did some showcases. And we got two labels took interest in us, and we went with PolyGram.
Now, how did you arrive on the name of World Trade?
That's a funny thing. Billy will tell you something completely different, but I remember exactly how it happened. When Logic was looking for our second record deal, we said, let's get rid of the name, get a new name. So everybody was getting names and giving names and all that. And I asked my dad, I told my dad, I said, yeah, we're looking for a new name. And my dad's from New York. He says, call it World Trade. So I submitted World Trade to the Logic thing, and it didn't take. And the band ended up calling ourselves Ocean's 11 because most of the band was from Vegas.
Right.
You know, in the old Sinatra film, Ocean's 11.
Yeah.
So, and lo and behold, you know, a year after that, they come up with a name for the band, and Billy goes, we got a name for the band. It's called World Trade. And I went, really? Where'd you get that one? But I remember where it came from.
Now, you brought in Bruce Gowdy, who had previously been a guy more associated with like that hard rock hair band sound.
Yeah.
He was fully on board with going more of like a progressive, yes, Genesis. Like, how did you get him to transcend into that?
When those guys started writing, it's always a synchronistic, what's the word I'm looking for? Well, it's a mashup between influences. So Billy's obviously a Yes guy,
mm-hmm.
you know, and Bruce is more of a Zeppelin guy,
right?
You know, as far as his roots. And when they put them together, you got this almost kind of a 90125 thing meets Def Leppard type of vibe.
Yes,
you know, and I love that. I thought it really tempered the progressive thing and made it more rock and roll and more palatable to AOR radio, I thought. And, you know, we're all chameleons. When we came in there, we listened to the style and went, yeah, I could do this.
Now, from a friend's standpoint, myself, this is an album that I absolutely worship at the altar at, as Mark mm-hmm. knows,
yeah.
the first World Trades.
Oh, yeah. I love that record. I think.
Well, that was my next question. Did you guys come away with the same feeling when it was a finished product?
No, I love that. I still go back to that record and go, we were onto something here.
Yeah. It's like a lost 80s Yes album, basically.
Yeah. I'm sure this is not going to be received well, but I think it's better than some Yes albums.
Yeah.
I do too. In fact, I think it's, again, I'm a geek when it comes to this album in particular. I think it's totally on par with the two albums they did with Trevor Rabin. As lofty as that sounds.
Well, that's nice to hear, because I think Trevor's stuff is just genius.
This album, in my opinion, was too. It was,
but you know, we were young and really hungry, and everybody was playing well, and every, you know, and Billy was singing his ass off, and the writing was good, and it came together. And Keith Olsen was a genius. I mean, I thought he made it sound really
good.
He
did. The production on it was tremendous.
Yeah. And like I said, we're all kids, you know, we were, you know, 30 years old, and Billy was even younger than that. He's like 24, 25. And it just, it had a thing, you know, it had a thing to it. I walked away from it listening and going, I still, to this day, I listen and I go, we did a really good job on that.
Oh, it's a brilliant record. Yeah. I mean, it really, it's the anybody ever asked me, like, there's so many albums where AOR tries to match, you know, or blend with progressive rock. Tell me one album you would recommend. It would be the first World Trade.
Yeah. And you know, listen, Billy's the genius behind that stuff, but no one can discount what Bruce did for that.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, the whole band was just phenomenal.
The way that it leans towards that, you know, that rock and roll, but, you know, it's like as loose and creative as Zeppelin, but as tight as Def Leppard. And that's Bruce, you know? And now, he's a bit of a genius there.
How did that record do, again, from me as a fan, as much as I loved it, it kind of fit in at an awkward time again, because now it's like the Whitesnake period and, you know, like all that sound. And it did it do as well as you guys expected it to do?
I think it was strangled in the cradle, that album. What happened was, you know, when you're promoting a record, you got to do the things that you got to do to promote a record. Part of that is shooting a video and trying to get rotation on MTV. The other thing is all the radio calls and the independent promoters trying to get it to X amount of Parallel 1 and Parallel 2 stations back in the old days.
Right.
And you want to start to track in Billboard. And all that was happening. You know, we had the video. We had some airplay on MTV. We had 125 big stations. And we were in the top 30 on Rock Tracks and Billboard. Everything was going great. And right when it got to the point where it was either going to take off or die, Yes came knocking. And Yes wanted, because, Chris Squire was the guest on that record.
Right. Yeah.
Because Billy had made friends with him. Ironically, he made friends with him because he came to see the Moody Blues at the Greek in Los Angeles. So he came to my show, and Chris Squire was also there, and they backstage, they made friends, and you know, and that kind of took off from there. But Billy and him really hit it off, and Billy's been a Yes disciple since I can remember. I've known him since he was 14. And Chris, you know, they had a lot. Trevor was gone and John was gone. And Chris had floated to Billy, you know, if Bruce and you came over, we could have a different version of Yes. So they came to those guys right when our album was breaking.
Oh, wow.
And they said, we want you to join Yes. Now, I can't hold anything against those guys. I don't know what I would have done in the similar circumstances.
Right.
But they said, yeah, we got a letter from management. Mark Williams and I got a letter from management saying, we're breaking up the band. The guys are going to, you know, it was great working with you, but the guys are going to join Yes. So that's what was happening. And that basically killed it at radio, because radio had heard that the band was breaking up, you know. So they're not going to get behind anything at that point.
Yeah.
And what happened was Trevor came back and there was no room for Bruce in the band. Yeah. And so they had a meeting where management said to Bruce, well, would you come along with Yes and just be a tech?
Yeah. Wow.
In the tour, to which Bruce looked at management and told him to go fuck himself.
Right.
That was the end of World Trade.
Wow. See, I didn't know that. That's terrible.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
And so you know, it went from World Trade dissolving right when it was starting to take off, and me being mad at those two guys. Yeah. And Billy, since I'd known for 9 or 10 years. And to me calling up Bruce after the whole thing was gone and saying, well, that didn't go the way we expected. I said, you want to get together and write? And Bruce says, yeah, let's get together and write. So we did. And it was the same thing. We were just writing to see if we can get tunes placed. And we wrote, I remember I brought one tune to Bruce. I brought him Let's Talk About Love. And we didn't have anybody to sing it. It was just Bruce and I doing, you know, keyboards and guitars. And I said, well, I'll sing it. I'll do all the backgrounds and I'll do the lead on it. And we finished it and we sent it to Warner Chappell. And they heard it and they said, guys, this is great. He says, you guys, what do you think about getting a singer? I didn't take offense. I knew better. He says, what about getting a singer to sing the demo? And I said, yeah, great. Who you guys have in mind? And they said, Mark Free. Now, I knew Mark Free because I played on his band's record in 1980. He had a band called Modern Design. And they called me in to play synth on that record years before. So I knew him from way back. Wow. So he came over to Bruce's apartment. He sang on this track. We mixed it, and it was like, holy shit, this is cool. We sent it over to Warner Chappell, and they go, this is really good, you guys. Write more. So it took us literally like a week. We had another four tunes and done. And we sent it off to them, and they said, finish this. Get an album's worth, and let's get a record deal. And literally, it didn't take more than a year of from the time we started doing demos to when we got a record deal.
Wow.
So there was a direct correlation to World Trade and Unruly Child.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was half of World Trade saying, well, that's over with. Why don't we carry on, but in a slightly different vein? And listen, I loved the progressive thing about World Trade. Absolutely loved it. But when Bruce and I got together, we were listening to the radio and we said, look, if we don't want this to be an uphill battle, let's at least try to compete with what's big on the radio right now. So we were listening to Bon Jovi and we were listening to Def Leppard and we were listening to that stuff and said, we could do that. No matter what, it's going to have our sensibilities, our progressive qualities, our love of 70s music. It's going to have that no matter what. So let's just target that and do what we do. And that's what we did.
Now, the debut Unruly Child is another album that I was a huge fan of.
Yeah, thank you. I love that, too. That's another album I listen to and go, not as much from the mixing standpoint, not like World Trade, but from the performances and the writing standpoint, I think we did a great job on that.
Now, it came out a little bit like past the cusp of the big burst of the hair band stuff.
Yeah, 1992.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely. That was another case of a day late and a dollar short.
Yeah.
So, you know, if it was 2 years earlier, we would have been, it's so funny, you know, the record company owner, Ted Fields, came into the studio when we were doing the mixes and he listened to some mixes and he said, boys, get ready to buy your houses in Malibu. Because he thought it was going to go through the roof. And had it been 2 years earlier,
it would have.
I think it would have.
It would have, because Mark Free was a guy. I mean, you know, I was plugged into the scene so much. Everybody was big into Mark Free, you know, like the King Cobra records. Then he did that Signal record. Yep. You know, he with the King Cobra, he had the Hard Rock guys. With the Signal, he had the AOR guys. Everybody loved this guy.
Yeah.
And when that album came out, it was 2 years too late.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it came out and Nirvana came out. That was it.
Yeah.
If Nirvana was going to kill Whitesnake and Winger, it was definitely going to kill us.
Yes.
Well, the other thing too, like talk about, you were on Interscope Records, right?
Yeah.
We had, was it Kevin Chalfant from The Storm, right? And they were on Interscope, but we talked about that. Wasn't it the fact that the label didn't really know what to kind of do with rock acts? Because becoming, right?
Yes. It was part that and something that I should probably not talk about, but. There was a falling out.
Feel free to if you want to.
Okay, so there's the owner, Ted Fields, at the time, and there was our producer, Bo Hill, who was in charge of the AOR stuff.
Right.
And, oh, God, I'm sorry, my memory. I think Tom Wally might have been at the label. And the guy who was
Jimmy Iovine?
Jimmy Iovine.
Yeah.
He was the guy. And I think what happened was, and I won't go into the story, but there was a falling out between Bo Hill and Ted Fields. Mm. At which point, Ted said to Bo, you're out and so are all your acts. Mm. And the top two acts he had at that time was The Storm and us.
Yeah. It all ties together.
Yep. Yeah.
So that was it. That was, you know, out of there. It was gone.
Mm. Now, did you guys tour a lot with that debut Unruly Child?
No, we played around town.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a great story. I think I've told this story in the press before, but you guys are going to love this. You know, when you're getting a record deal, you get some front money, but it's not going to ever be enough to float you for the whole year.
Right.
You know, they give you like $10,000-$12,000 each. And as we well know, that's in Los Angeles, that's not going to pay your rent for a year.
Right.
So I was doing tours at the time. I was playing with Air Supply. I was playing with this big Japanese artist that Bruce actually helped me get the gig on this. And it was he paid so well that we could go out for 2 or 3 months and have more than enough money for a year. Mm. It was, you know, it was like silly money. And John McPhee, a guitar player from the Doobies, was his band leader. And John came to Bruce and I when we were finishing up the Unruly Child record and said, Yazawa wants you back for the tour. And it was right after we finished the record and right around the holidays, there wasn't going to be any trouble, you know, with promotion or anything like that. So we said yes. And our producer came around and said, you guys can't take that tour. And I said, well, that's crazy. I said, if we don't take this tour, how are we going to survive? And everybody in the band was trying to convince us to, you know, work at Conroy's Flowers or you know, get a gig at a restaurant or do something else that wasn't going to, you know, make you enough money to really have the free time to pay attention to music.
Yeah. You know?
And I said, guys, that's ridiculous. All we got to do is go out for a couple months, make our money, and then we could devote the whole year to promoting this record. And Bo came around to Bruce and said, Guy can go, but if you go, I'm dropping the band. Mm-hmm. Right? So then the guys came to me and said, you can't take the tour. If you take the tour, you're out of the band. Now, mind you, if you remember how the band started, the band started with me bringing a song to Bruce and us writing together. Right. And then Mark came over and then it was just the three of us. We signed the record deal and then hired people to fill out the band. But they came to me and said, and I was the writer on about 90% of the lyrics and, you know, in every song to some degree, maybe one song I was a writer on. And they told me that if you take the tour, you're out of the band. And so I called their bluff and said, I'm taking the tour.
So is that why you weren't on the second album, the one with Kelly Hansen?
No, that was something different. So they said, you're out of the band. They literally said, you're out of the band. And the next week they were dropped from the label and I was on the road. I was gone. And Bruce turned that tour down. So he wasn't on that tour. So, and I was kind of mad for about 3-6 months. And I came back and Bruce had done a new Unruly Child record, but he had used material I had written with him anyway. Mm. You know, I just wasn't there to record it. But I listened to the record and it's a lot of my material too. So I like the record. I like that.
That's interesting you said that because I was just telling Mark before we went on the air, the second album is real good. It's got some great songs on it.
Yeah, and that's Kelly Hansen singing.
Yes.
And Kelly's killing it. Kelly sounds great.
Yes, it's a really strong album.
You know, at that point, Bruce had a falling out with Mark. And the band just basically just blew up, disintegrated. Yeah. They gave it a little bit of a shot after I was left. They changed the name to 12 Pound Sledge.
Right, I've read that.
And they tried to get another record deal, but nothing happened. And then it just went... And when I came back off the road, Bruce and I started talking and he said, want to get together and write? It was the same thing all over again.
Right.
And we were just writing just to write because, you know, that's what we do. We get in the studio and we write. And a lot of those tunes ended up on, I think they ended up on some release later with Frontiers.
Well, then there was the Unruly Child 3 with Philip Bardouville singing.
That's right.
Right. Which was...
That's right. And that's because Bruce was working on Philip's solo record. Mm. And Bruce said, let's get Guy to come in and co-write some stuff with us. So I came in and co-wrote some of the stuff on Philip's record. And we liked the way everything sounded. And we said, maybe we should just do another Unruly Child record. You know, and we weren't going to call it Unruly Child. We were going to call it Macbeth. Mm. And then we were talking to the label and we said, yeah, what the hell? Let's just call it Unruly Child.
Now, how did you get, because he was from the Christian scene.
I didn't even know that. Yeah. I knew that he was in the Beach Boys at the time.
Oh, he was. See, I didn't know that, but he was in the Christian rock scene before that. I think that was the first album that he was on with you guys, was his first album into secular music.
Yeah, I had no idea. I didn't know about that stuff.
Yeah.
It certainly didn't stop the way that we wrote lyrics together in a very secular manner.
No, he's a really talented guy. He's got a terrific voice and
great voice.
Yeah.
Nothing bad to say about Philip.
No, he's been on some really good records aside from that. So at this point I wanted to take you back to the World Trade a little bit.
Sure.
And the second album, which came out on Magna Carta.
Yes.
And that was
95.
Yeah. 95. Bit of a different beast from the debut. What was your feelings on that album?
Well, that was Billy. That was Billy saying, I'm going to do another World Trade record and let me Guy come in and play some stuff and Bruce come in and play some stuff. And he didn't have Mark play drums. He had Unruly Child's drummer, Jay Schellen.
Right, Jay Schellen played on it, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, it's always nice to get together and be creative. And there was something, there was a tune left over from the first World Trade's writing sessions, I think, that he used. But for the most part, that was really the Billy show or the Billy and Bruce show.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we were talking about that.
It was kind of a meandering record. I mean, as much as I, you know, like the first album, I lost my mind over the second album. I guess I expected something similar to it, and it was nothing resembling the first album whatsoever.
No, I didn't. It's not going to go down as my favorite.
Yeah.
World Trade, you know, output for sure. But the first album is heads and shoulders above that.
Yeah. And I guess for you guys to have done a proper second album, it would have had to been more in correlation of the band staying together and working on a proper follow-up.
Yeah.
Rather than...
It wasn't like, you know how bands do second albums. It wasn't like that. It was like, oh, we have an opportunity to sell something under the World Trade banner.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, even just by the cover of the album was like, I mean, could you come up with something?
that
like a blob.
I'm responsible for that.
Are you really? That was god awful.
Thank you. Well, I was just learning Photoshop.
Oh, okay.
But even the last one that was out on Frontiers was the same type of thing. It's like Frontiers saying, hey, guys, can you get together and do a World Trade record? Well, I think that was Bruce and Billy trying to write together, but mostly Billy controlling the thing and getting Mark to play, but Mark not really doing what Mark does. And then sending some tracks over to me and saying, Guy, play some Moog solos on this. You know, it was that type of thing. So.
I mean, the third one, at least to me, was more like, at least song-wise, structured more similar to the first album.
To the first one, yeah. I agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely like the third one more than the second one.
Yeah, I'm with you. Now, by the way, to bring it up to Unruly Child, when Mark was now Marcy free, and Frontiers sent an email to Bruce and said, what do you think about doing an Unruly Child record with the original band? And we hadn't talked to Marcy in 9 years. And so Bruce said to me, what do you think about this? I said, well, just give him a figure that'll scare him off and what we want to do it for, you know, and see how serious they are. And they said, yeah, we'll do it.
Wow.
So I said, okay, all right. If they're going to give us our ask, we'll get everybody together. And that record was more like a coming together of the original people. Because when we got together, there was that feeling of excitement about it and not just, oh, let's just slap the Unruly Child name on something.
Yeah.
It was more like, what can we do that's as cool as the first one? And I think that one was well received by the fans. They really liked it.
Yeah, and then that was really the first introduction of Mark/Marcy Free being back with with the band and being in that setting. Yeah. And it definitely went over well, more so than the previous albums, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Although I just listened to a couple of cuts from the Philip Bardwell version the other day, and I was like, you know, that's pretty good.
Yeah, I just re-listened to that album literally yesterday, the Philip Bardwell, and it was really good.
Yeah.
And the Kelly Hansen album I thought was terrific also. I mean, I know you weren't on that one, but the songs, you had something to do with some of the songs on it.
Yeah. Well, the album was named after this demo I gave Bruce right before I left to go on the road. And I think it was called Waiting on the Sun was the song. And I think they called the album Waiting for the Sun. I don't know why, but I think it's the last track on the record. And I really love what they did with that production wise. I thought it was very cool.
Yeah. No, that's a terrific album. Yeah. Now, I wanted to talk, before I turn you over to Mark, who has a lot of questions about other bands. You were on the Frederickson Phillips album, which is another album that I not only loved, but was unfortunately so displaced in time coming out in 95.
Yeah.
Had it come out, you know, in 88.
Yeah.
With those marquee guys on it, with those songs. What songs did you play on that album?
I honestly don't even remember. I know that Ricky Phillips was producing that record.
Right.
He's a really good friend of ours, and he was actually the bassist on almost the entire Unruly Child album.
Oh, really?
The first one. He played all the demos. We brought him into the studio. He played bass on everything, and we wanted him in the band, but he was being courted by Jimmy Page and David Coverdale.
Wow.
They wanted to put together a trio. And so, you know, he said, well, I got to go with that. And we were like, yeah, of course you do.
Right.
Yeah. Although I don't know if anything came of that. He's a real talented guy. And he contacted me when he was doing Freddie's thing and sent me some tracks and said, I need you to do this, this, and this. But I honestly don't even remember what I did.
Well, thanks to Mark and his note-taking, I could tell you, you played on Captured and Hopelessly Lost.
And you
Captured co-wrote. Is the best song on the album.
Oh, okay.
You co-wrote those songs, right?
I did?
I think.
You co-wrote Captured?
I don't know if I did.
Captured is like a monumental song.
Maybe you just played
it. I don't know if I wrote on that.
Maybe
listen,
just played
find
on
out if I did. I got to tell my publisher to say something.
Well, maybe I'm mistaken.
You definitely played
on them. Yeah.
Yeah, because Captured had that big Hammond organ part in it.
Okay, I might have done that.
Yeah.
I it's so funny. There were so many things that, I mean, God, that's like, it's 30 years ago now? Yeah, I guess.
That album came out in 95.
Yeah.
Wow. One of the greatest albums that came out one of the worst times in the history of hard rock. That was such a brilliant album. And it's just, you know. It wasn't even on a major label.
Yeah.
That would have been huge if it came out in 88, especially with him. Oh yeah. Because it had the name recognition of those two guys too.
Yeah.
And I'm going to turn you over to Mark now. He has.
Well, no, I mean, let's kind of pick up. I know you mentioned some of the bands when you were talking earlier, but I guess let's start with the Moody Blues. How did you get involved with that?
That was sheer luck. Logic had been broken up for 2 months, April, May, June. No, 3 months. Logic was broken up for 3 months, and I was working with various people in the studio and trying to get songwriting going and seeing what could happen. And Bruce Gowdy calls me up and says, "Guy, the Moody Blues lost their second keyboard player for the North American tour. You should try to get on the tour." And I did my customary thing. I thought he was messing with me. And I just said, "Yeah, right. Fuck you." And hung up. And he calls me back. He goes, no, I'm serious. They last minute, they lost their keyboard player. I said, "Well, what am I going to do?" He says, "It's Jerry Weintraub's Concerts West is handling the band. They're the management." He says, "Get the number and find out who's handling the band." So I did. I called up Concerts West, and I got Tom Hewlett on the phone. I think it was Tom Hewlett. And I said, I hear through the grapevine that the Moody's are going out on the road. They lost, Mraz is the keyboard player in the band, but they had two. They lost the hired guy on the other side of the stage. And he says, yeah, that's true. And he says, but don't worry, we hired somebody, we got somebody. And I said, you did? I said, the band hired somebody? He says, no, the background singers recommended this guy and we're going to go with him. And I just had like just a couple seconds to think on my feet. And I said to him, I said, so let me get this straight. You guys are going to bring this keyboard player into the rehearsal that they're going on the road a couple days after rehearsal. The band didn't hire them. And if this guy sucks, they're going to blame you. I said, why don't you guys tell them that you've got a couple of guys they can audition that are great. And then when the band makes a decision, it's off of your shoulders. And he stopped for like a pause, like 20 seconds. He goes, you know, that's a great idea. He says, come on down here. I'll give you the catalog on cassettes, learn it. And you'll fly out to Dallas on Saturday and they'll audition you on Sunday. And they'll pick whoever they want and you'll go on the road or you'll go home. So I took the car down to, it was on Sunset and PCH, the office. And I grabbed the stuff and I came back home and I just crammed and learned as much of the set list as I could. And I didn't really have that much gear, you know. I had a couple of synths and I called up my friend Steve Picaro and I said, I got an opportunity to audition for the Moody's. He goes, you're going to want to take an emulator with the Mellotron patch in it. So he set me up and they said they flew that stuff out. And I saw the guys in the hotel the night before and I was nervous as hell. It's like, I mean, these guys are legends.
Sure.
Yeah. And I'm sitting there talking to them and I was just probably shaking like a leaf, you know. And I got to the rehearsal place and it was an aircraft hangar. It was huge. They were flying the very lights for the concert. The full stage was there. Wow. The front of house mix was 100 feet out in the audience. It was like a real gig. Huh. And and when I got there, everybody was there except the band. And they had two keyboard rigs set up. And I met Patrick Mraz, who I'm a Yes disciple. So that was like a moment for
me. Oh, yeah.
To meet Patrick. And I said, where's the band? He says, I'm going to audition you. And I said, great. And the other keyboard player wasn't even there yet. And his rig was twice as big as mine, really? Like right next to me. You know, he had just come off a David Lee Roth's tour. And so we played. You know, we played for like 5-6 songs. And he's clear on the other side of the stage. And he's just calling off songs. There was a drum machine going and we just played the songs down. And I mean, I had to say to him, what part do you want me to play? Because I learned everything. And he said, am I playing this part or am I playing that part? He goes, oh, no, play that part. I'll play the other part. So we did that. And he came over to me and he shook my hand. He goes, you're great. He says, I love the way you sound. He says, you sound like me. And I laughed and I said, yeah, well, I was way into Relayer. So yeah. you're one of my heroes, you know. So the guys got me in a van, the two road manager. Oh, no, it wasn't Tom Mueller. It was Jason Rafalian. And I can't remember the other guy, but the other guy's like this guy that had been with Zeppelin and the Eagles. And he was like an old timer, you know, they get me in one of these runners, you know, and I'm young, I'm mid 20s. And they said, we're going to go get you lunch. So they get in line to a McDonald's and they turn back and they look at me and they go, so kid, they called me kid. Cause I was 18 to 19 years younger than everybody there.
Yeah.
They said, kid, what do you want? And I said, I don't know, a couple cheeseburgers and some fries. And he looks at me and says, no, what do you want to do the tour? And I said, what are you talking about? I said, Patrick is auditioning the other guy right now. He says, Patrick doesn't like the other guy. Patrick is doing that as a formality. He wants you. Yeah. And I looked at him and I said, I'll do it for free.
And all the cheeseburgers you could give me.
Yeah.
They both laughed at me and they said, we'll get you a decent pay for it.
Who was the other guy? Was that Brett Tuggle?
No, it was.
You mentioned David Lee Roth. That's why I was.
It was Jesse Harms.
Jesse Harms. Okay.
Oh yeah. Wow, Jesse Harms. Hmm.
So I came back. Jesse's stuff was gone. My stuff was on the riser in the proper position, And the band was there. Mm. And they just started calling off tunes. And that was it. It was from like 2 o'clock to 6 o'clock that day. And the next day from 11 o'clock to four, because they had to break everything down. That was the whole rehearsal I got. And then it was on the road.
Wow.
And it was mind numbing for me because, yeah, I got to see this a little bit with when Logic opened up for Supertramp. But, you know, sitting on without any risers, being on the flat stage in front of the curtain, you know, 10 feet from the lip of the stage is a lot different than being on full risers all the way back with very lights hitting you and lasers going over your head and smoke going off and playing Nights in White Satin.
Right. Wow.
It was a completely different thing. And I remember, I've told this story before, but I remember the second day we're playing Nights in White Satin and I'm lucky enough to have the Mellotron sound. So I'm doing all the da, 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 playing all that stuff. And I'm just, I got the same thing. I got goosebumps playing this stuff. And Justin turns around to me after the song is over and he stares at me and he goes, "Why are you smiling like that, kid?" And I just looked at him. I said, "You wouldn't get it."
Right.
And that was it.
Wow. You know?
And then because you're really a fan playing.
Yeah.
Right. They don't get
that.
I mean,
we're playing Tuesday afternoon and I'm sitting there going, I'm playing the piano part and I'm going, I can't fucking believe I'm doing this.
Right. With these guys.
With these guys. And here's the kicker. You're going to love this. When we broke down, and Patrick and I are like buddies now. So when we break down, Patrick comes over to me and says, "Hey, I have a friend of mine playing at the Hard Rock in Dallas." Because we were in Las Colinas, so really close to Dallas. He said, "Playing in Dallas." He invited us to the show. He said, "After the show, we'll come back and hang at his hotel and talk. We don't have to leave until the next day at like 1 o'clock to get to New Orleans, where our first concert is going to be." So he says, "You want to go?" I said, "Sure, I'll go." "Who is it?" He goes, "It's Chick Corea." So I go from trying to get a gig to getting the gig to hanging out with Patrick Mraz and going to see Chick Corea live, to hanging out with Chick Corea in his hotel room.
Wow. Hmm.
To then going on tour with the Moody Blues. This all happened in the span of 4 or 5 days.
Wow.
And everything changed for me. Literally everything changed right there.
Wow. It's like the Keyboard Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
Well, it was surreal. Yeah. I remember we had a private, a G3 or whatever it was, a turboprop that we flew around in. The band did not travel by bus. Hmm. The band traveled in a private plane.
Oh, really?
And so I'm sitting there, I'm playing cards with Graham Edge, and Justin is sitting right over there, and Patrick is over here. I'm sitting there staring at everybody in the Moody Blues, and I'm the only hired musician, in the plane, you know, in the background singers, the two girls, and the tour managers. And I'm sitting there, they're like bringing us sandwiches and I'm drinking and I'm playing cards with guys from the Moody Blues. And I looked out the window and I said to myself, if the plane went down right now, I wouldn't give a fuck. This is unbelievable.
Right.
Wow.
Because it was one of those moments, you know, and as it happens, you know, you start doing more of this stuff in the industry and you get used to it. Mm. What was mind blowing becomes, still great,
yeah,
but it becomes, it's like, well, this is what I do.
More commonplace than
not really commonplace, because every time I go out and I see an audience, I don't care whether it's 2,000 or 60,000, I go, holy shit.
Right.
But I also, in the back of my mind, I go, this is what you do. Get ready, do your thing. This is what you do.
Yeah.
So
I'm hopefully going to get a chance to meet Patrick later this year, because he was supposed to play in New Jersey at an event called the Prague Stock.
Oh, cool.
Last year, but he was sick. So he said he had a little recorded message during the festival and he said he's going to come back this year. So hopefully get a chance to meet him, I think late October or so.
He's a fantastic guy. I haven't talked to Patrick, literally. I have not talked to Patrick since probably 1990.
Wow.
So.
Yeah.
He might remember me.
Yeah, I'll have to bring it up.
Yeah, I'm sure he remembers you.
So let's jump ahead of this, because you mentioned a little bit before about Toto. You brought the name up. We talked about Fergie Fredrickson, the album you did a couple songs on. Jump to 1994, Bobby Kimball, the Rise Up album comes out. You play keyboards on that?
And
you
Bobby picked for his album, for Rise Up, take a look at the tune stack.
There's five Unruly Child songs.
Yeah, it's all album. Unruly Child material. And Bruce calls me up and says, Bobby's going to cut our songs on a solo album.
So that was his idea. It wasn't like you brought him there. He actually wanted it.
It was his idea. And then Bruce says, we should get together and write a tune with Bobby, just the three of us. I said, yeah, let's do it. So we literally went over to Bruce's condo, and Bobby came over, and Bruce had a little drum groove, and he had the chords going for this thing. And we just sat down with pen and paper and just started singing stuff. And, you know, it was like Bobby going, what if we do this? And I go, great. What if we do that? And we just, and the song literally, and I'm talking about Anna Lee.
Okay.
Anna Lee was born in 45 minutes. That's it. Done.
Wow.
And then we literally, it's one of those things where while we're getting the ideas for the song, we're writing it down. We're recording vocals. Mm-hmm. We're going, oh yeah, sing this. And it's, so what you're hearing on the album is a writing session.
Oh, wow.
Really? It's not like, okay, we've got it written, now let's perform it. It was more like, this would be a good verse. What do you think about this? And he sings it like, try this. Great. Oh, that's perfect. There we go.
Huh. So what was that? That was kind of Bobby Kimball's like sort of comeback, because it was about 5 years before he even got back into Toto at that point.
Yeah.
Did you guys play any shows or anything like that at the time?
I did. No, there was nothing that I did live with Bobby on that stuff ever. Although Bobby and I were going to do a record in, believe it or not, in 86 in Europe. And I remember I got the passport and we got all the stuff in order and it fell through. But we were just Bobby and I, and there was one other gentleman, I forgot his name. We were going to Europe to write and record a record. And of course that was, you know, due to the association with Toto.
Yeah.
You know, although at that point, I think he was out of Toto.
Yeah.
No, he was out of Toto in 86. Sure.
Yeah, I think Fergie was in the band at that point.
Fergie or Joseph Williams?
Joseph Williams, 86.
86, 87.
Fergie was there in 86. Fergie was there like 84, 85. Joseph Williams was there in 87.
Yeah.
Just to jump in, what made him think that was a good idea by culling half of your album? Because I remember somebody turned me on to that album when it came out. They weren't familiar with Unruly Child. You got to hear Bobby Kimball's new album, the songs and tracks. And I'm listening. I said, I know these fucking songs. Like, this is off the Unruly Child album. And
so I have no idea.
And I honestly never warmed up to the album because it was just like, it was like a cover version of Unruly Child. Right.
Yeah. I mean, listen, all things being equal, that's not my favorite version of those tunes.
No, me neither. Yeah.
But I, you know, I was happy. Look, as a writer, you're happy to get your stuff on another piece of vinyl.
No, I understand why but I never understood why Geik Boy. He thought that was a great idea by covering like all those songs off Unruly.
No, I mean, listen, if I'd had my druthers, I would have said to him, screw that, let's just write another batch.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
Right.
Because as you heard with Anna Lee, we could have written another batch and it would have been great. But I think probably what happened there was, to whatever degree, I think there were some good songs on that first record. Even if you just take it out of the fact that it was this style and, you know, and it was this band, just the songs themselves. So there were some good songs.
Oh, the songs hold up. Yeah. No question about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in the middle of all that, I mean, we got to touch on Air Supply because, I mean, I've seen the band probably three, four times, five times over the last 10 years or so. I love that band. And I know people, you know, will say, oh, Air Supply, soft rock, blah, blah, blah.
People don't understand how cool that band was.
I know.
That was one of the favorite bands that I ever played with. So okay. Let me tell you what happened there. When Logic broke up, Michael Sherwood and Jimmy Hahn from Logic ended up in Air Supply.
Okay.
And I was supposed to be in Air Supply too, because during the time I was with the Moody's, I was recording at Graham Russell's house for his rock opera that he was trying to get off the ground called The Heart of the Rose.
Okay.
And he asked me every year if I could come play with Air Supply. And I said, well, when is it? And I said, oh, the Doobies are going, not the Doobies, I'm sorry, Moody Blues are going out at the same time. So it conflicts. Mm. And he would, and Graham would come to the shows. He'd come to Moody shows and hang out and visit with me. And we would still work together on recordings, but touring, I couldn't join Air Supply at that time. And then in 1990, I was working on The Earth Is with Air Supply. And I think Harry Maslin was producing that record.
Okay.
And we were up at a recording studio, somebody's house, Brad Buxer's house, in Beverly Hills. And I had found out that I was released from the Moody's. They had released Patrick Mraz and me.
Wow.
At the same time. And so I was, that was it for me, but I was doing another tour anyway. I was doing the Yazawa tour in Japan. And Graham and Russell started talking about this tour they wanted to go on where they weren't going to have drums. It was going to be called A Night with Air Supply, and it was just going to be a grand piano, a mic'd grand piano, an upright bass, acoustic guitar, and vocals. That was it. And they were going to do... they were going to play The Sheds without drums, just doing that. And they were talking about it. And I heard them, and I, in my head, I thought, oh my God, this is going to be, there's going to be so much room, you know, if there's no drums up there to really, you know, it was like, you know, the Elton John record, 11-17-70, that live record they did. And it's like got some of the most brilliant Elton John performances on piano. In my head, I'm thinking, what a great gig this would be on grand piano to just have those tunes, but be able to take it in a rock and roll direction. And so I said to those guys, I'll do that tour. And they looked at me and said, great. That was it.
That was it.
That was it. And we went out and did that tour. And I remember we had all these tunes that were like these love songs, right? But you're playing in these 20,000 seat places, right? Yeah. 10 to 20,000 seat places. And I said, we have to rock this stuff out when it comes to just the music section.
Yeah.
Right. So I just said, I'm going to do this like Elton John, you know, and it's just going to be aggressive, you know, that type of sound. And they loved it.
Nice.
And that turned into this great tour for that year. And then the next year they brought back the full band and I stayed on. And it was great because Graham was very generous on bringing me into writing sessions and recording sessions. So I made a lot of records with him, got a lot of songs on records, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. I mean, you spent, 6 years with the band, 4 studio albums, a live album.
Yeah. I mean, by the time all these best of compilations came out, yeah. I ended up on another 5 records.
Right.
Anyway.
Yeah, that's true.
It's hard. But it was really good and it was very creative. And it was funny because Graham was way into Peter Gabriel at the time. So we really started getting, it was Air Supply, but it was progressive. Especially when you listen to some of those records and you hear where they were leaning.
Yeah.
And we had the best players in Los Angeles playing on that stuff. We had all the cats were playing on it. And Vinnie Colaiuta was on it. Lee Scolar was on it. JR was playing drums. Michael Thompson was playing guitars. You know, it was like, it was all these. My first session that I ever did of a tune that I wrote on an Air Supply record was me, Lee Scolar, and Vinnie Colaiuta on the cutting track. And I looked out in the studio and I went, this is my tune on an Air Supply record. And those guys.
Right.
This is fun.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, you mentioned Michael Thompson. You did an album with him, right?
Yeah, Michael Thompson is a really good friend of mine. I love his playing. Always have loved his playing. And oddly enough, one of my best friends, who is no longer with us, George Hawkins, bass player, had a band with Michael Thompson years ago. And George kept telling Michael, he says, I got this keyboard player. Because I was on tour with the Yazawa thing with George Hawkins.
Okay.
And George kept telling Michael, who's a good friend of his, he goes, I got this keyboard player you've got to use. He's you'd love him. You're going to love him. You're going to love him. And oddly enough, Michael didn't know who I was. He was playing on the Air Supply records. And he mentioned it on the session. He goes, who's playing piano on this? I love him. And then it all clicked for him that it was the same person.
Oh, wow.
And so we became friends. And I started working with Michael and hanging out.
He did a solo on a Mark Anthony album. The first one, he did the English album where he sang in English. And I remember it was one of my favorite solos. And I've always loved him, obviously, as a session player for so many people. But that one solo is always stuck in my mind.
He's one of those guys. He's a superstar in guitar.
Yeah.
As soon as he sets down, it's like first take or second take. You hear it and you go, that sounds like the radio.
Mm.
You know, it's that good.
Yeah. Wow. So let's kind of move on to the year 2000. When did you join? See, let's go right to it. The Doobie Brothers. Let's talk about that.
I told you that I got that gig with the Japanese artist, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Bruce Gowdy was playing guitar. And the other three guys on my first tour with them was Willie Weeks on bass, Doobie Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
John McPhee on guitar, Doobie Brothers. Keith Knudsen on drums.
Right.
Okay. And then me and Bruce Gowdy.
Okay.
That was and Albert Wing was playing sax. He was from the Zappa band. And the horn section were the Fowler brothers from the Frank Zappa band.
Hmm.
So it was kind of like all of a sudden I'm on stage with all these, you know, like, oh God, these guys, you know, you gotta step your game up a little bit. And that was really great. You know, and Yazawa asked us to come back the next year. That was the one Bruce turned down. So they replaced Bruce with Dweezil Zappa. But it was the same guys. So we started doing tours every year. And so, you know, I was still playing on tour with Air Supply and making records, but I would leave. And for 3 months out of the year, I would go on tour with the Yazawa band. And so I became really good friends with John McPhee and Keith Knudsen. And then George Hawkins replaced Willie Weeks on the second tour. So I became good friends with him. And fast forward to 97, I guess.
Okay.
Is that, or 96? I can't remember when I joined the Doobies. Maybe 96?
Yeah.
I think it was 96.
Okay.
They called me up. They had a live album, video and it was going to be released as a video and also a CD.
Right.
And there were some tracks that needed cleaning up in the piano department, the keyboard department. And so they called me up and they brought me down to the studio. And they played me these tracks, and I had to clean up about 9 or 10 of them. And I ended up replaying, you know, the stuff that was on the video and on the CDs. And when I was through with it, the manager who was there at the time took me aside and said, the guys want you to come out on the road with them. Hmm. And I said, I'm leaving in a week to go to Australia with Air Supply.
Yeah.
I said, I'm going to be gone for 3 weeks. And he says, I said, well, when are they playing? And they said, July 4th was the first gig. And I said, well, I'll be back about a week, you know, it was like a month away. I said, I'll be back a week and I'll be able to rehearse and go out with the guys. So I had to go to Australia and tell the Air Supply guys I was leaving to join the Doobie Brothers. But I thought, you know, at this point, I had been with Air Supply for quite a few years and I was a really big Doobie Brothers fan.
Mm.
And I thought, you know, this probably be a nice opportunity for me.
Sure.
So that was it. And I left and I started playing with the Doobie Brothers, and that lasted just under 20 years.
Yeah. And you recorded the studio album in 2000, Sibling Rivalry.
Here's what happened there. We're recording it at Lizard Rock, which is John McPhee's recording studio up in near Solvang. And the guys would come in, you know, Pat would come in and Tommy would come in and Mike Hostack would come in and Keith would come in, but the whole band was never there at the same time. You know, it was like everybody was doing, you know, it was like, oh, Tommy songs or Pat songs. And, you know, everybody would play on it, but it was, you know, it was like a tracking session, drums and bass, you know, and whatever the guitar track was. And then everybody come in and do their thing. And the only people that were there every day was the engineer and me. Even McPhee wasn't there as often as us. So when we got three quarters into the album, I remember Pat and John came up to me and said, you're the only one that's here every day. You know, we're going to just make you a producer on the record.
Ah, okay.
So I said, okay, that's fine with me, you know?
Hmm.
And so that's how that happened.
Okay. So that brought, I guess, when did you leave the band? 2019 or so?
No, 2015 was my last touring year.
Okay.
The very end of 15.
Okay. All right. And then, well, yeah, you did the the Unruly Child album was 17, 2017.
Yes.
And then what have you been doing since then?
Well, we did. So every time Frontiers said, you know, you guys want to do another album, of course, I'd say, yeah, come on, let's just get together and write it. Because we were enjoying just, you know, carrying on the Unruly Child tradition, you know, and what else are we going to do? Let's record. So we did a bunch of records. We did a live record, and we did another set of studio records. I don't know how many, three or four. And you know what happened? What kind of was the monkey wrench and everything was COVID.
Sure.
When COVID happened, everything stopped.
Yeah.
Tours stopped. Doing sessions at the studio stopped.
Yeah.
The whole thing just came to a screeching halt. And it was the first time in over 30 years that I wasn't on the road at some point in the year. So that kind of just, you know, froze everything for a while. And then after we got over that, I started going back out on the road again with the Japanese artists that I had initially met the Doobie Brothers through.
Oh, okay.
So literally ever since 2015, I've been working with Gisela.
Oh, okay. What type of music is that? If I can ask.
It's rock and roll.
Just rock. Okay.
Yeah. But he's so big over there that the venues, like for instance, we'll do 8 nights at the Budokan.
Wow.
Or we'll do the Tokyo Dome.
Really?
Which is 60,000 people. He's enormous over there. He can't even sell the tickets like a normal artist. He has to have a lottery for who's able to buy tickets.
That was like Led Zeppelin in 1977.
Wow.
Yeah. So I do that, and that's a lot of fun. And I work for him. Like last year, he gave me a recording assignment to do, and I'm just right here in my studio. I do work, and you know how the internet works now. You do work, and you send stems.
Send it off, yeah.
And so I can just be here at home and do, like he just had me do, he's doing a new record, which I actually have to fly this Monday to Los Angeles to do some tracking in the studios that he picked in LA. But just last week, I just did all the work for one of the songs here, and I just sent him the stems, like, you know, we transfer.
Yeah. Okay. No,
it's a different day and age. It's not like the 80s where you have to get cartage and bring your stuff somewhere.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, I know Tom, when he was setting up the interview with you, and he said, you know, we got to do it tonight because you're heading out to LA to do something. So, but is there anything, Tom, that you wanted to talk
just
about?
On the Frontiers end of a thing, that's a type of deal where they just give you a blanket, whatever they pay you, and nobody's in the studio and there's no plans of touring. It's just do an album and that's it.
Well, you know, they asked us to do a couple of things, you know, and it's kind of expensive to get a band, you know, like Unruly Child is not going to sell a lot of tickets, right?
Yeah.
So it's expensive to get that band and gear over to Europe.
Right.
You know, hotels and flights and everything else and, you know, to play a gig. But we did. We did one in Nottingham and we did one in Milan. Mm-hmm. And I did another one in Milan with Michael Thompson.
Yes.
And the one that we did in Milan with Unruly Child was a live DVD.
Right. Yeah.
And that's, oh my God, is that a horror story?
Let's hear it.
Well, it was one of those things where gear was lost on the way over and they promised me a piece of gear and it was never that gear and it wasn't really functioning and Bruce didn't have his rig. Ugh. He had a guitar and a Marshall back there, which is not exactly what you need to do an Unruly Child show.
No.
And, you know, and it was, and we lost our sound halfway through the show.
Jeez.
You know? So when you look at the show, it's like, well, we didn't, I kind of look unhappy when you look at me, but I think everybody pretended to do a good job. And what I wrote into the contract was we get to mix it, which basically meant, it's like anything I hear that's screwed up, I'm fixing.
They could fix it, yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's like, oh, okay, that was messed up. Let's fix that. And that was messed up. Let's fix it. And so we did that.
Yeah.
And actually, that live record sounds pretty good. like you said, we, you know, they never asked us to do any tours, you know, or stuff like that. And we definitely had it in our contract that they didn't have any say in the material. Mm. There was just like, we'll deliver you 12 songs at this length or more, and whatever we give you is what you get. So
okay, you answered my next question, because they're notorious, or at least people have put out things out there that they are very, with certain, I guess, lesser known acts, do a lot of elbow bending as to what they want something to sound like.
Oh yeah, God yeah, and I think they probably wanted to do that with us, but we simply told them, look, we're not into that.
Right.
If you want a record from us, that this is how it's going to be.
Okay.
We're going to give you our creative vision, and it's going to be great. You're going to love it. Mm. It's basically our attitude.
I think the more name band, I mean, Toto had been on that label, Whitesnake. Yeah. There was a lot of bigger, I'm assuming those are the bands that, you know, got away with not being told what to do.
Absolutely.
But they also have a roster this long of bands that you could see that, you know.
They dictate.
They have the same, you see the writers are the same, and, you know,
the
production's the same. It's not bad, but it's very samey.
They have a team over there.
They have a formula, and they like to impart that formula on every band to an extent if they could.
Yeah, that just wasn't going to work for us.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
Yeah, and I know they recognize that. I mean, there was a little bit of grumbling and complaining, you know, on some of the stuff we did. But I remember when we turned in the first album that Marcy came back on, they sent us an email immediately and said, this stuff is fantastic. We love it. So we were pleased with that.
And that was on the first album that Marcy came back on.
Yeah, and I forgot the name of it now.
The first one that is real good.
I got a list.
It was our fourth studio record.
It would have been the fourth. Yeah, right. Not counting the basement tapes.
The basement tapes was, those were our demos.
Yeah, no, I know. Yeah.
Worlds Collide? Was that the one?
Worlds Collide.
Worlds Collide. Yeah. Thank you. That was it.
Yeah,
that was
Worlds Collide.
I had to go shift through my notes here real quick. anything else?
I'm good.
No. Well, Guy, we really appreciate this. We appreciate you taking the time to talk to us tonight. Some real good stories. Got to hear a lot of stuff about your career and all the years
thanks,
there.
Guys. And I didn't say anything salacious.
Not at all. Everything
pretty
was
well
good.
Behaved.
But thank you so much for this. We appreciate it.
All right. I appreciate you guys taking the time.
Yeah. Thanks,
guy.
All right.
You guys have a good night.
Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
Take care.